Well, before we leave your story for a moment, if you had to graph your development in terms of breakthroughs and plateaus, what that description would look like? Like 5 years of plateau, breakthrough.
Right. Right. Well, can it go downhill?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. It just
did it go downhill? Were you meditating?
No,
did you meditate? Have you been meditating the whole time for the last, 30 some odd years?
The last 30 lifetimes. I mean, here I was, Duncey Spurtferger, finest delicatessen in Rome. Yeah, I mean, it's very, I was going to say the stock market, but you really don't want to get into the stock market.
I'm just not sure it's going to serve you, Ken.
Let us go back to 1939 and the Great Depression. And in terms of positive, I can give you kind of the positive graph and also sort of some of the negatives. Because they intertwine. You have different developmental lines. So sometimes you're going really quite well in some ways and really not very well in others. And for me, the kind of down parts have had to do with physical problems in particularly this REDD, which is RNAase enzyme deficiency thing, which is a little enzyme glitch that I got in Nevada in 1984. And under really severe physical stress, it's really interesting because then you watch what happens to their currents. And if you deal with them, if you're lucky enough, and I do mean luck in part, if you're lucky enough to deal with them well, you can just really accelerate growth. And if not, you really just go to hell. I mean, it can be very, very difficult. But the sort of positive, I'll give the positive graph first, then describe some of the difficulties that occurred. I really think that my growth and development up through around age 17 or 18 or so was a very sort of average, in a sense. It was very, very normal, kind of a relatively healthy family. I was an only child. My father's in the Air Force. My mom and dad are great people. They're incredibly intelligent. They're funny. They're attractive. My dad was a really great athlete, and they're just really handsome people. And funny. They tell funny stories, and they're easygoing. So I always consider myself very lucky, and I got a great education. Starting around 17 or 18, though, there was a big disjuncture because my parents were very, in a sense, conventional. My mom was Southern Baptist and, dad was in the Air Force. And all of a sudden, this is the 60s and there's Vietnam and my dad's in the Air Force and I and I'm reading Krishnamurti and all my friends are dropping acid and I'm drinking vodka for breakfast just for fun to see what it's like. And this was, okay, that's going to be interesting. So I went through an incredibly accelerated, and this is what I mean by a positive. I think this is the positive part. I think I had great positive stuff as a child, but it was typical for anybody who was lucky enough to have the upbringing that I had. I didn't have any major satoris or anything when I was young. But when I was 17, 18, 19, I went through a whole series of crises that were very difficult. I was at Duke University to be a doctor. Immediately knew I didn't want to do that. And in effect, just quit going to classes entirely and got straight C's, which was just unheard of because I was A student, valedictorian, all that kind of, I was the perfect, all-American kid until I completely dropped out. And so then I'm reading Krishnamurti and, doing Zen and drinking beer and partying, and it was absolutely ridiculous. But out of that, I realized I very quickly had to sort of get into sort of interior growth and not just exterior. So that started, I think, the first real burst of growth in my own life, due to a lot of really terrific teachers. Bob Young, that I mentioned, was my first mentor. Katagiri Roshi, Gestalt therapist I was working with, and so on. And the period from around 18 to around 22, I think, was some of the worst time of my life because I was, dropping out. And this is very, for a conventional kid, it was very hard. So I left Duke. I wasn't going to be a doctor and so on. I immediately went back to college because I really didn't want to fight in Vietnam. So I ended up getting a master's in biochemistry and a PhD minus thesis. I did not want to do that at all. So I was really writing these other things and practicing and all that. So that was the first really growth period for me. And then I would say in a certain sense, it kind of plateaued and I was really digesting. I think I was still growing, but relatively speaking, it was a kind of a plateau period. And that was all through my 20s. And I'd settled down into, a very strong meditative practice. And I was writing a book a year and washing dishes at the Red Rooster restaurant. And I did that for a decade and then went to Cambridge because I had founded Revision Journal. Jack Crittenden and I had founded Revision. So I spent a year in Cambridge right outside of Harvard, actually Harvard Square, and then left there and went to San Francisco where I stayed with Roger Walsh and Francis Vaughn for a year. And there I met Treya and married her. And that started a 5-year period that was again, one of the very hardest in my life, but probably the single sharpest growth period I ever had as well. And I think that's because what we did for each other in terms of our own spiritual growth and development, because the pain and the terror and the agony was so horrible that you either really just committed suicide or you came out of it on the other side. And because we were alternatively incredibly strong for each other, we both just had a quantum leap in our own growth. And I describe this in Grace and Grit, and it's still, that 5-year period is, you know, the most important, dramatic, transformative period in my life. And then out of that, she wanted me to write Grace and Grit. I tried to do that for the first year after her death, and I couldn't. But about a year after that, I digested it enough that I did. And then I went straight out of that, and it's like all of the that material, all of the growth that we had gone through came together. And I think I came out of that in as strong an awareness as I've ever had. And I sat down and wrote Sex, Ecology, Spirituality, and went into that 11-day experience. And then I would say really that, after SES, Sex, Ecology, after Treya, Sex, Ecology, in that 11-day period, I mean, that's enough for 10 lifetimes as far as I'm concerned. I feel blessed to have a fraction of any of that. And but then after that, I plateaued a bit until I would say really about a year ago, and there was another kind of shift. It's a little hard to describe, but it was just a further dying to my own Ken Wilberness, I guess. I don't know how else to really describe it. And it's, in a sense, nothing I hadn't seen in that 11-day period, but it's just more, it just drenches me more. The motivation that I have for writing and stuff is, it's just radically non-personal. I just have no personal, in that sense, motivation for it in certain ways. I still recognize, I mean, there's still Ken Wilber, and I'm still, you know, in this body and sitting here and all of that. But the awareness is somehow clarified, and it strikes me anyway as very encompassing. And I think it's not an accident that this period of my own work, I'm now working with first, second, and third person perspectives that we talked about. I'm really emphasizing that, sort of creating a whole new, I'm reinterpreting quadrants, levels, and lines based on that. I think that's part of this deepening, what I hope is a deepening of that 11-day experience that started about a year ago. It's actually been pretty interesting. It's been a very, very interesting year. The physical up and downs that have gone with that were this illness that I contracted in that 5-year period with Treya. And then that sort of plateaued out during the next decade, and then had a really bad kind of flare up about 5 years ago, and had to go through that. And it's just flat out, it's a physical, it's caused by environmental toxins and a virus infection. It's not contagious. It knocks out your mitochondria. So it can make physical energy can be very, very low. Sometimes you actually can be bedridden. So I had a flare up of that, and was down for about 6 months, 8 months, about 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that actually in certain ways, again, if you can handle it, contributes to a deepening of awareness, because you really, really have to get into states of radical emptiness and acceptance of everything that's arising, or you really will go nuts. And so you don't want to be facile about this, but on the other side of those horrible experiences, you're grateful for those horrible experiences. But if somebody said, well, do you want to grow more? Do you want more of that horrible experience? I go, no, thank you. I don't want any more of that. But on the other side of it, I'm glad it happened, because it killed certain things in me that wouldn't have died otherwise. In other words, I was able to let go of certain things that I wouldn't have been able to let go of otherwise. And once you let go of something, you can go back and inhabit it with vitality and awareness. You're still allowed to do it. You're just no longer identified with it or attached to it. So I think I can write with more, even more vitality, even though in a certain sense I care less. In other words, I'm not attached to the outcome of it. And therefore there's an enormous amount of vitality and energy in it. Anyway.
Talking about painful experiences that bring growth, when do painful experiences not bring growth?
Sometimes it just produces bitterness, you know. It's so, the hard thing about it is, it's like we were talking about the whole key to growth and meditation, psychotherapy and development, is the subject of one stage becomes the object of the next, the subject of that. And so for that to happen and be growth, then when this subject You're about to disidentify with this subject, hopefully, in order to find a higher subject. If that subject is brutalized, tortured, put in pain, has misery inflicted on it, has illness and so on, and meets it with a certain kind of attitude, then it helps growth. Yes, because you let go of that. You go, okay, wow, and you disidentify with that and you can rise to a higher level. But if you can't, then you just become bitter and jaded and hateful and you resent it and you never, ever let go of that. And that happens a lot. And I see it myself. I see it in my friends as well, enlightened friends as well, that sometimes they grow and sometimes they become bitter. And I think it's always a mystery in how people manage to actually do that. But I think it has something to do with being able to have a loving acceptance, an awareness, a letting go, an equanimity, a witnessing, or still hanging on and still resenting and still bitter and still blaming. And under those circumstances, torture makes you uglier and uglier. Pain makes you uglier and uglier. And you just never know how it's going to go in your own case, you know.
It's interesting that in talking about the major breakthroughs in your life, that some of them at least were periods of crisis, but you also had periods of breakthrough that weren't pain related.
Right.
I mean, often some people say, you know, no pain, no gain, whatever, you have to have these crises in order to grow.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad you're getting divorced or ill or whatever, because at least now you have an opportunity to grow. And, and so, you know, my question is, yet you can also grow without pain and crisis?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I think the no pain, no gain comes only because people, they go through a whole lot of pain and then they gain, then they remember the pain, you know. Whereas if they don't go through pain, well, they don't remember it. I mean, that's sort of, it's sort of like psychic capacities. It's like people say, now I always know, you know, I think the phone's going to ring, and then it rings. And they remember the times it does. But the 100 times that they think it's going to ring and it doesn't ring, of course, you forget those. And so you get this sort of distorted perception about what's required. I think that's true with sort of no pain, no gain kind of thing. A lot of growth is just natural. It does. It can be fairly graceful and easy and so on. It's just when pain is tossed into the mixture, which, you know, being life and humans, it sort of always is, it's that then when you grow, you really remember because you're coming out of it. And it's much more memorable to come out of pain into the sunshine than to come from one sunshine into more sunshine. People don't tend to remember that as much, but I think it happens a fair amount as well. The positive stuff can also lead to growth. Oh, we were talking about being in sports and having very exalted states, and those could lead to growth. That would be an example of very positive things leading to growth, for example.
It's interesting also when you graph your story how your spiritual growth paralleled developments in your work, your writing. And I wonder how you see that. Like, for example, in order to articulate more complex theories, did you feel that you've had to grow as a person so that you were at a higher frequency? This is my language, but I'm curious how you see the connection.
I think that's certainly part of it. And I think for men in particular, men tend to sort of identify with their work and women a little bit more with their relationships. And so women often have stories of growth and transformation based on relationships, what they went through. It could be a mother with her daughter, or a daughter with her best friend, or her husband, and so on. And there tends to be a lot of transformative tales coming out of relationship. And for men, it's often out of work and their relationship to that. It's hard to say which comes first, too, in men. It's sort of chicken and egg kind of thing. It's sort of you have to grow in order to be able to write good stuff, let's say. Or does the writing itself have the meditative effect, as you were describing, and that actually lets you grow while you're doing it. I think both of them happen. Aurobindo, you know, his only practice was writing. He didn't meditate. He felt that writing was indeed his actual practice. And I think that certainly happens. In my own case, it kind of mirror each other fairly closely. You can't help, I mean, especially if you're writing on stage conceptions, you can't help but notice when you're sort of going to higher stage and you're quoting, you know, down in the lower levels, you're dealing with Attila the Hun, you know, and the Hell's Angels and stuff. And then the higher stages, you're like quoting Emerson and, you know, Thoreau and Plato and stuff. And it's just everything changes because you're really mirroring that in yourself and you're kind of echoing it in yourself. You're resonating with it in yourself. And that's, you keep doing that and it becomes its own form of practice because you're resonating with that as you write. And then hopefully what you do in that writing is when you are authentically resonating with those higher states, then you can convey that if you're a gifted writer. And so that's one of the things that I try to do. Obviously, I do very academic stuff, but I try to break it up every now and then and give sort of direct kind of transmission or pointing out instructions of those states. And a lot of people, that's the favorite part of the writing. And they just sort of wade through all that academic crap just to get to that other stuff.
Okay, and finally, the 11-day period that you went through. What catalyzed it? Why did it stop? And
See, that's what's so bizarre about these things. I have no doubt it was right in the intense period of doing sex, ecology, spirituality. And I've had three periods of extremely intense, and I can't use too exaggerated terms for this. It just dynamite. It was just plutonium intense periods of theoretical turmoil. And one was in my early 20s when I was trying to look at the traditions and the whole notion of a Garden of Eden, that we were once in a high estate and we fell out of it, and it's been straight downhill ever since. And it was a whole theoretical thing. It was very, very difficult, and I resolved it to my own satisfaction. And I did a book called The Outman Project and Up from Eden at that point. And students of my work call it the switch from Wilbur 1 to Wilbur 2. I have sort of five phases. And that was the first big one. And it was very, very difficult. And it's very unpleasant. It's just it feels like being drawn and quartered and electricity shooting through your body. And I just hate it. The second one happened with SES. And I was looking at all these developmental hierarchies. So the Jane Lovingers and Carol Gilligans and Lawrence Kohlbergs and all that. Then I was looking at the great chain of being and the seven chakras and Plotinus's, great chain. And they all seemed to fit together somehow, but then they really didn't. And I couldn't figure out. It was so tantalizing because they looked so goddamn similar, but they really weren't fitting. And so when I was doing SES, I'd locked myself. This is the one period that I was actual hermit in my life. And I locked myself up in my house for 3 years. And just did SES. I saw four people in that entire three-year period until I finally figured this thing out. And what it was, I had 200 pages, legal pages, all over the floor with all these different hierarchies written on them, all these different developmental sequences, whether it was biological development or social development or cultural or psychological stages and so on. And it finally dawned on me that they fell into four classes. And those four classes were the four quadrants, and that's actually how all of that came about. And once I saw that, the whole book sort of fell into place. And it was right during that period that I had that 11-day experience. I have no doubt that it was all intertwined. And that whatever that cognitive work I was doing created a clearing or an opening, and which is more integral awareness, could manifest in my own case. And I believe that was very closely intertwined with that. And then the third time that intense kind of thing happened was a year ago when I said another deepening, I believe, occurred. And that was working on perspectives, this first, second, third person, and trying to figure out what does it mean to say that a third person has a third person view of a second person. All that sort of stuff is just mind-numbing. I mean, just truly horrifying. And I ended up coming up with a sort of what we call integral mathematics, which is an actual mathematical system based on perspectives. And as sort of complicated as that sounds, and it is, and don't ask me to explain it, or I really will put myself to sleep. But it was so hard doing it that I really spent months in that same sort of agonizing state, and I had all those yellow pads out again because I couldn't figure it out. And that only happens at horrible times. I never have to do that. So I had, oh, no, not the yellow pads. So out came the yellow pads, and oh, God, it was like 2 months, and I was sick, and I had a fever, and it was horrible. And then all of that, and there's this other kind of, what appeared to be this deepening that came out of all of that. So when you're working particularly on this kind of thing, I think work is almost impossible to separate, almost like Aurobindo's in that sense. I mean, his own writing was his own deepening, his own realization. And when you're writing about these things, then you, in a sense, you become, in a strange way, sort of your own teacher in that you sort of activate your own higher intelligence that writes it down, and then you catch up with yourself when you actually study what you just wrote down.
It almost sounds like a type of rewiring.
It feels like it, too. And I think it really does have to do with those subtle and causal energy currents. I think those really do get rewired. And again, I think, the science of the future, I think, is going to be able to track a whole lot of that.
Now, you mentioned how spiritual awakening might be different for a woman or someone who's more identified with the feminine. It might be in terms of her relationships.
Right.
So I'm curious, because you haven't brought in the word love in this discussion at all. And just for you, if there's been some experience of love, whether that's, you know, for the world, for however you might define that, that has accompanied the awakening experiences.
Right. And we talked a bit earlier about yin and yang and sort of the experience of men and women as they
the
move
types,
through
yeah.
gross, subtle, and causal in terms of types. And women traditionally have the same experience, and they describe it in terms of love and relationship, caring, concern, and so on. And men, again, you know, not to say that you have to do just one or the other. There's usually a balance. But men tend to talk in terms of those more agentic terms of witnessing and awareness and freedom and equanimity and justice, which is how I would tend to talk.
Which is why I want to make sure I get the feminine part of you on tape as well, here, Ken. Yeah.
Both of them come together in sort of one taste. So at that point, being one with everything that's arising is the love part. It's the absolute connection or love connection with everything that's arising moment to moment. That's the feminine side of one taste. And that's fullness. In other words, you are literally full when you are one with everything. And the feminine principle, women more tend to want fullness and men want freedom. So women want to be full of chocolate and full of relationships and full of love and full of radiance and full of light. And men want to be free of all of that. They want nobody tying them down. They're free. They transcend. They break the bounds. Men are happy when they're pushing limits and breaking them. But the only way you're going to be radically free, again, is if you transcend everything. So both freedom and fullness come together in one taste, because you are free of everything because there's nothing outside of you that can hurt you, but you're also full because there's nothing outside of you you could want. But my own subjective inclinations are to describe that on the masculine terms on the way up, so I do tend to talk in terms of freedom and so on. But theoretically, I include both. And actually, my own life, what women have always provided is that love connection, that love component. And Treya certainly stands out in terms of that. Because that was a, as I described in Grace and Grit, it's where I think you learn to love to infinity by loving a finite thing with such intensity that it just breaks the bounds of the finite in that sense. And so I always described it as definitely as a heart opening, and that was always what I felt she had done for me, basically. And I felt that particularly in the last several years we were together, because I quit writing. I really stopped everything. I was a support person around the clock, really, for 3 years or more. And particularly in the last couple of years, I felt that service was just that. It was a service of love, and that's really all it was. And there was, at that time, if you had talked to me, there would be no talk, really, of freedom or transcending, because that wasn't what you were doing. You're being immanent. You're touching. You have to be present, and you have to be right there. But it's a fullness that's beyond right there. That rewired me. I think that fundamentally rewired my constitution. Even though I haven't mentioned those terms in my writing recently, that stuff creeps in. As does I actually use things that are. Just horrible sometimes. I've used the word chocolate a couple of times because I was trying to describe the texture of the feminine and how it looks at being one with the world. And I'd mentioned it was like, no, who wants chicken soup for the soul? It was like chocolate for the soul. And one moment, yeah, that's right, chocolate for the soul. I went, okay, I think I know what we're talking about now. So those terms are ones that are slowly creeping in to my vocabulary. But as somebody who, with a Y chromosome, I natively tend towards freedom terminology.
This concludes Session 7 of Cosmic Consciousness with Ken Wilber. Our program continues with Session 8.